Hello and welcome to the November edition of the Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
This month, it's another 5-carat diamond of astronomy knowledge for you.
That's right, Quinton. We have the Astro News, a history section, and we answer your questions.
And later on in the show, I'll be speaking to Bob Carswell, who's going to be talking to us about quasars and what they can tell us about the intergalactic medium.
Coming up this month in Cambridge, we have Hoyle Day at St. John's. This is going to be on Saturday, November 8th, from 11 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. in the Old Library.
And for those of you who don't know who Fred Hoyle was, he was one of the greatest cosmologists of all time. He even coined the term the Big Bang, despite being against it for the majority of his lifetime. He died in 2001, and the main building here at the Institute of Astronomy is named after him. Now, the tour at St. John's College will show you the old libraries and an exhibition of items from Fred Hoyle's life, giving you an insight into his interests and personality. And there's also a talk by Dr. Caroline Crawford from the IOA. So, Anna, what's going on in the night sky this month?
Well, Quinton, Jupiter is very bright at the moment, and it'll be staying with us throughout November, hanging low in the early evening twilight. It's well worth a look, particularly with binoculars, to pick out the 4 Galilean moons, and then on November 30th, we'll see a grand display of a thin crescent moon rising just below Jupiter and Venus. They're only going to be 2 degrees apart, which is 4 times the width of the moon. Good telescope objects this month are the open cluster M11, which sits in the tail of the constellation Aquila, and also the colorful double star Albireo in Cygnus, the Swan. If you're lucky, you may even catch a Leonid meteor during the middle of November, but they're really fast, so keep your eyes peeled.
Thanks for the heads up there, Anna. Now it's over to Laura with the astronomy news.
Hi, I'm Laura Churcher, and welcome to this month's Astro News. IBEX probe to study the edge of the solar system. NASA's Interstellar Boundary Explorer spacecraft, IBEX, has been launched into Earth orbit to study the edge of our solar system. IBEX was launched on Sunday and is the first probe sent to study particle interactions at the boundary between the solar system and interstellar space. The interstellar boundary is the point in space at which the particles emitted from the Sun begin to compete with those from elsewhere in the galaxy. This region serves as a buffer that protects the solar system's interior from 90% of the cosmic rays heading towards it. The 2-year mission should shed light on the decline of the solar wind, which has dropped 22% in the last decade and is at its lowest pressure in 50 years. The 2 Voyager spacecraft, which were launched in 1977, are currently in the termination shock zone where the particles from the Sun crash into those from interstellar space. The Voyager spacecraft are making fascinating observations of this important region. Phoenix update. It's been a tough time for the Phoenix lander lately. Not only has it been battling dust devils, it is also in a race against time and temperature as it struggles to resolve some key questions about the red planet. The onset of the harsh Martian winter means that there is now less sun to charge Phoenix's batteries. However, researchers at the University of Arizona hope to activate the lander's microphone soon and record the sounds of Mars for the first time. The principal investigator on the mission, Professor Pete Smith, said, "We are still valiantly searching for organic molecules. We'd love to be able to claim that we had found organic materials in the northern plains of Mars. We are pushed right down to the wire in our last samples to try and make that case, so I don't know if that will happen or not. I hope so." Phoenix is on a tight deadline, as Mars's orbit takes it behind the Sun, leaving Phoenix without power and freezing temperatures from the 29th of November to the 15th of December, and nobody is sure whether we will be able to regain contact with the probe after the blackout. Did volcanoes spark life on Earth? In the early 1950s, chemists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey of the University of Chicago tried to recreate the building blocks of life under conditions they thought resembled those on the young Earth. They filled a closed loop of glass chambers with water and different mixes of hydrogen, ammonia, and methane. Then, in an attempt to confirm a hypothesis that lightning may have triggered the origin of life, they zapped the mixture with an electrical current. The researchers then analysed the residue and found it contained traces of some of the amino acids that make up proteins. Their presence suggested that the basic molecules needed for life could form through a simple chemical reaction started by electricity. The problem was that theoretical models and analyses of ancient rocks eventually convinced scientists that Earth's earliest atmosphere was not rich in hydrogen. Last year, after Miller's death, two of his former graduate students, Jim Cleaves and Jeffrey Bader, were examining samples left in their mentor's lab when they discovered vials of products from the original experiment and decided to take a second look with updated technology. They found traces of 22 amino acids in the experimental residues. That's about double the number originally reported by Miller and Urey and contains all of the 20 amino acids found in living things. Although Earth's primordial atmosphere was not hydrogen-rich, unlike the chambers in the Miller-Urey experiment, gas clouds from volcanic eruptions did contain the right combination of molecules. It is possible that volcanoes, which were much more active early in Earth's history, seeded our planet with life's ingredients. The big question is, what happened next? How did these molecules turn into self-replicating organic compounds? That's the frontier, Cleve says, and we're sort of stuck there. That's all for this month's news. Check out the Cargo Bay area of our website for more information.
Thanks for that, Laura. It's time again for our history feature, where I'll be telling you about another physicist whose work has become indispensable for modern astrophysics. Theodore Lyman was an American physicist who lived from 1874 to 1954. He came from a wealthy family and obtained his degrees at Harvard, where he was convinced to study physics after taking a course on optics. The only time he suspended his research was World War I, when he directed soldiers and engineers in France. Scientifically, his major contribution was designing optics equipment and studying the way that light is absorbed by different gases. This work is very important for revealing the inner workings of atoms in each gas. Lyman's famous discovery was a specific pattern of absorption caused by hydrogen atoms, what we now call today the Lyman series. Today, Lyman's discovery is used when we look at the light that is being absorbed or emitted by hydrogen. Since hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, the Lyman series is essential to our study of gas in the cosmos. To tell us more about the applications of Lyman's work to astrophysics, here is this month's interview. Over to you, Quinton.
Hello and welcome to the interview section of the AstroPod. This month I'm speaking with Professor Bob Carswell from the Institute of Astronomy. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Oh, thank you, Quinton. Well, delighted to be here, I think.
So, Bob, this week we're going to be talking about quasars and how they tell us about the intergalactic medium. So sort of as a very sort of, you know, quick introduction, a lot of people sort of think that the universe has galaxies, and in between these galaxies, there's nothing there. So what exactly is going on in the intergalactic medium?
Well, I mean, probably the best way of thinking of it is if you start off in the early universe, you're forming everything, galaxies, the lot, from some giant mess. And basically the intergalactic medium is the materials left over from stuff that never quite fell into galaxies as they formed. So you've got a whole load of material just distributed through space in a fairly clumpy way, and that's what the intergalactic medium is. Only light clumps, but they're
clumpy. So it's just a lot of sort of junk left over from the
Big Bang. It's just a lot of junk left over from the Big Bang. Yeah, that's a good description for it.
So we often talk about quasars as well, but we sort of use the term without really describing what a quasar is. So, you know, tell us.
Well, that can be a big question. Probably the best description of a quasar, or what is we think is a quasar, is basically it's a very bright event in the center of a galaxy. And by bright event, most galaxies contain black holes in the center, it is believed, of one sort or another. Normally a million solar masses in our own galaxy, or 3 million solar masses in our own galaxy, for example. And then they get, and some people estimate about almost a billion in some cases. And now black holes, you know, are black normally, you expect. But if there's a lot of material falling into them or stars being shredded around them, then you get a lot of, there's a lot of energy involved in that. And so they produce a huge amount of light. If there's material around them, either falling in or going around them and knocking into each other, there's a huge amount of energy available. And so what quasars are the very bright manifestations of a lot going on near a black hole in the center of a galaxy. And that they're really extremely bright because they can have, luminosities of hundreds or thousands of times that of a galaxy as a whole. And that's why you can see them so far away.
So the process involved in taking matter from far away from a black hole and getting it close to a black hole is, in fact, very efficient and releases a lot of energy.
Yeah, well, only when you get very close in. I mean, the very far away stuff doesn't matter very much. But the sort of so-called, what people think of in terms of a disk of matter going round the black hole as it's falling in with its angular momentum, there's a huge amount of, you can release up to about half the gravitational energy from that as you get very close in.
So. With these quasars being extremely bright, just how far away do we find these objects?
Oh, huge distances. You can see them, what people say is almost to the edge of the universe. I mean, the universe is, if you could see right to the edge, it's 13.7 billion light years. And I guess the furthest quasar is about 12 billion light years. So, you know, it's a long way off. And you recognize that distance in a sense because of the expansion of the universe, and so you can sort of measure their Doppler shift, their effective velocity, and what we call the redshift is something that we relate then directly to the distance.
So as the quasar is further away, we sort of see this redshift getting bigger.
Bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah.
Now, if we've got these very, very bright objects sitting very far away, how do we use these to tell us about the intergalactic medium?
Well, I mean, any matter, whether it's hot or cold, will contain atoms. And atoms, the important thing about any atomic species is that they, well, absorb or emit light at characteristic wavelengths, depending on what atom is there. So we can recognize, for example, carbon because it will absorb it at some color, some wavelength of light. And it's easy to see silicon because it absorbs at different wavelengths. And so you can see patterns of these things and see what they are. And so all we do, and if I have a very bright light behind a gas cloud of any sort, or even a sodium street lamp, I will see what are called atomic absorption lines effectively in the spectrum when the light has is broken up, characteristic of the atoms I'm looking through. So even if I'm looking through a sodium street lamp with a very bright torch behind it, I'll see a characteristic little pair of orange lines which will be taken out of that of the light beam. And, you know, that's true of anything. It can be an intergalactic cloud 5 billion light years away, and the same argument applies.
So these absorption lines correspond to electrons in these atoms absorbing light at a very...
Well, basically what happens is each atom has electrons in what are called energy levels, and they have to jump from one to another. And so when the energy of the light comes in at precisely the energy to make it jump from one to another, it will absorb at exactly that wavelength. That's why the thing works. So it's an atomic process.
So our quasar sitting very far away is much like a very, very bright torch.
Yeah, nothing more than that. That's the way they're used, in fact. So you're looking, basically all you're doing is you're looking at where the torch beam, if you like, goes through a particular cloud, and it will have some redshift. And so I will see characteristic absorption from hydrogen normally, because that's the most abundant element in the universe. And then if I find another cloud closer to me, the redshift won't be as great, so I'll find this sort of characteristic hydrogen, but at a different wavelength. In fact, if it's not as far away, a somewhat shorter one.
So the different wavelengths are in fact caused by the clouds of hydrogen gas being at different distances from us.
That's exactly right, yes. So, you know, different distances equal different redshifts, so different wavelength shifts as far as we're concerned, so we can see it that way.
Looking at the spectrum of the quasar, then, we must see a whole sort of line, a whole set of absorption lines in the spectrum.
Yeah, since hydrogen is so abundant and absorption is actually extremely efficient, you can see a little picket fence of these things when you just sort of marching down right all the way up to the redshift of the quasar, where obviously it has to stop because you can't see beyond, you know, where the object is, where the light is, basically.
With this technique, what have we actually been able to sort of learn about the intergalactic medium? What's it telling us?
Well, I mean, it tells us actually a fair number of things, some of which are expected and some unexpected. The first thing is, the most important thing actually is just looking at the structure of the universe as a whole. If you, people who make the simulations of the growth of structure in the universe and with cold, dark matter and everything, they have to get the right amount of material left over in their models. And so basically it's one of the components that goes into making sure that, you know, they've got it right, if you like. And if you have too much dark matter or too much clustering, then you find the characteristics of the picket fence, if you like, are very different from what's seen. So in some sense, it's used to tune the models to get the growth of structure of the universe as a whole right. And that's been a very important component, I think.
This is where we can sort of look at the sort of actual fundamental dynamics of the universe as a whole.
That's right.
And check that they're, you know, right against our models.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of sort of complex sort of processes that go into getting this picture right, and I don't think we have completely yet. But, you know, the basics are pretty much there, and it's certainly true that the model makers, one of the things they try and do is to get the Lyman Alpha Forest right. And so they might have to tune their parameters a little bit in how they make the models, if you like, or change them.
While I'm in Alpha Forest, we mean that sort of picket fence type structure.
That's exactly what I mean. That's exactly what we mean.
Apart from hydrogen being obviously abundant in the universe, do we pick up any other elements when we look at the spectra?
No, that's the other important thing, actually. It shows that the intergalactic medium is hardly, as far as one can tell, not very much enriched in terms of heavy elements like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and things like that. In other words, not much has got out from the galaxies, at least at an early stage, and back into the intergalactic medium. I mean, it must have at some level, and I suspect if we looked really hard, we could probably find abundant things, normally abundant things like carbon and oxygen, but that hasn't been done yet. The one should see is helium, because that was formed in the early universes as well. But we're also restricted by what wavelengths we can observe, and helium's outside that range, so tough luck.
Now, with the advent of better telescopes and more space telescopes coming in the future, what are we hoping to sort of, you know, pick up?
Well, the better telescopes, better these days means bigger, doesn't it?
And more expensive.
And more expensive. The space telescopes that are planned probably won't tell us a great deal apart from about objects far away, in a sense, because the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be mostly infrared oriented. And this, by the nature of atomic lines in cold matter, tends to be ultraviolet wavelengths. So what we'll really gain from the really big telescopes is the prospect of being able to seeing what the heavy element abundance is in the Lyman Alpha or the intergalactic medium much better, because we'll be able to push it much deeper with better signal to noise. But there's a very exciting experiment to try and measure the Lyman Alpha Forest, wait 10 or 20 years and see how it's moved, so you can see, look at the deceleration of the universe. Now, that's a very hard experiment, but, you know, people are devoting a lot of effort to simulations and trying to get it, to see whether it will work, and it looks fairly promising. So I think that's a really exciting thing, to actually measure the rate of change in the expansion of the universe with a really big telescope. It'll take a 30 or 100 meter, but it's only a football field of glass.
That's a big telescope. Well, we're all really looking forward to the results. And thanks for coming on the show and, you know, explaining what is a very important area of astronomy. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Bob and Quinton. Now it's on to the question and answer section. This first question is for you, Quinton. Why is it that eclipses have different speeds?
Well, one reason that these eclipses have different speeds is because we have two kinds, partial eclipses and total eclipses. Now, if you think of the sun and the moon as disks on the sky, now as they travel across each other, if it's a total eclipse, the disk of the moon has to travel all the way across the disk of the sun. However, it's just a partial eclipse, the disk of the moon just has to travel a short distance across the disk of the sun, which means it's going to take a lot less time. But there's another factor involved here, and that's the fact that the moon isn't on a perfectly circular orbit. It's on what we call an elliptical orbit. And at different times on its orbit, it's at different distances away from the Earth. And this distance varies by about 10%. Now, when it's closer to the Earth, it means it's moving a lot faster. And when it's furthest away from the Earth, it's moving a lot slower. So that can affect how long an eclipse takes as well. Our next question is for you, Anna. Why would we want to put a telescope on the moon?
Well, it turns out, Quinton, that there are two main reasons for putting a telescope on the moon. The first reason is that the moon does not have an atmosphere. The motion of gas in the Earth's atmosphere blurs light on its way to a telescope, and this limits the clarity of images taken by a telescope sitting right here on Earth. Additionally, the Earth's atmosphere blocks out light with particular energies, so we just cannot observe that light from the Earth. These problems are not present on the moon because the moon has no atmosphere. The second reason to build a telescope on the moon is that the moon is a large and stable body, so that telescopes on the moon can be larger and more permanent than orbiting space telescopes, such as the Hubble Space Telescope. Two major lunar telescope projects are in the works. One is for a liquid mirror telescope, and the other is for a radio telescope array. So keep an eye out for these updates in the coming decade.
If you'd like to have your questions answered on next month's show, just send us an email to astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk. It's now time for more astronomy-related depravity. It's the astronomy joke of the month.
Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Jane.
Do you have a joke for me this month?
Indeed I do, Jane. Drum roll, please. How does the sun keep his trousers up?
I don't know. How does the sun keep his trousers up?
With an asteroid belt.
Well, Jane and Michelle, thanks for the joke this month. I'd just like to remind all of our listeners that the sun doesn't actually have any trousers at all. Well, that's about all we have for you on this month's show.
Thanks for listening.